Some seeds can only take root after a forest fire. It's the same in life. Sometimes what used to give us shelter, structure, meaning, becomes the very thing that's starving us of life. Maybe what we need is a wildfire. Burn the wreckage to the ground. Let the seeds take root. Kill the master. Seek the king.
We packed up to tell the story of a young lady who lost her daughter.
So there's a extremely high correlation between suicide, mental illness, and substance abuse.
Come on the ground. Come on the ground. Sir.
I think as of this year, there's about 14 million people in America who have a co-occurring disorder, and a little more than 7% of them seek help for it.
You know, in my addiction, I felt like I was better off dead.
I'm here to talk about my daughter, Megan, who committed suicide when she was 28.
There's enough hope in the people that do recover to where I keep going and keep showing up at places where I'm needed.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right. We are live on the internet. My name is Christian, host of the Most High Show. With me today is my good friend Britt.
How you doing?
Pastor, counselor. I just put those words together. Pastor. He's a pastor. And, you know, I'm one of the great gifts of doing this show and doing these things is meeting amazing people like you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really cool. We met last year sometime. We did a documentary called Megan's Prayer, which
has
been
great.
Thank you. It's been a powerful tool in helping people understand the correlation and just the suffering that comes between mental illness, addiction, and suicide. And I know you've used it, and we've shown it in public spaces, and hopefully we'll be doing that again next month. And so that's where we met, and you dropped the knowledge. You dropped the wisdom, and so today we're getting together to do the same thing. We're empowering people with some information about some stuff. But before we dive into all that,
you got it.
Just give me. I'd like to know what you felt was the call. What pulled you into this direction of vocation? And it's more than a vocation. I mean, this is a way of life for you.
Yeah, it's a calling.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I struggled with addiction, bad addictive disorder for a lot of years in my 20s. And going through treatment, getting closer to God, really learning that there's a lot of people hurting out there. And I started feeling really, 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 really called to do something about it, to do my part to help others. A treatment facility that I went through and graduated from hired me to work there for a year. I worked in the office, talking to guys on the phone, seeing guys when they came in and when they left, and I saw lives transformed. I really fell in love with it, and in 2008, I made a decision, made a promise to God that with His help, I was going to pursue this counseling and psychology thing, and, you know, had to go to school, took quite a bit of school to learn how to do it, be able to get credentials to do it, and I'm passionate about it. I love it more today than I did the first day I started, and it's all I want to do the rest of my life.
Wow. Yeah, I've always I love to see someone who's got a goal and then does all the work.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to be like, oh yeah, I want to help people, And then you go online and you go, oh, that's how much it costs. But you went, oh, that's how much it costs, and that's the time investment, really. Yeah. I mean, how many years of school did you say you had?
So when it's all said and done, I'll end up with, including undergraduate, I'll end up with about 10 or 11 years of school.
Whoa.
So five, six, seven of those being postgraduate, and then you have your internships and your residencies. But the process was awesome. And when it comes to this, in my experience, the journey was the destination. And so there was a lot of hard times. I got married during that time, started having kids during that time, which really gives me a whole new perspective when I'm sitting across from someone struggling with mental illness, struggling with addiction, who's married, you know, who has kids involved.
Yeah.
Right? It takes it up a whole nother level.
Yeah. Right. So today we're talking about a specific topic, which you had a bunch of names for. I think we put in the description, co-occurring disorder or dual diagnosis.
Yeah, those are two of the main three terms we use.
Yeah, and so why don't you give us the definition of it?
Yep.
And then I'll translate it into normal people.
English. All right. So the three terms Christian mentioned, there's co-occurring and dual diagnosis. A third, a little bit more clinical term, is comorbid. But they all basically mean the same thing. It's someone who has been diagnosed with both a mental health condition and a substance use disorder.
Yeah.
Sometimes those occur at the same time. Sometimes one occurs first, then the other one follows, right? So in other words, sometimes you'll get a mental health diagnosis, struggling with depression, anxiety, personality disorder, bipolar disorder, and you begin using drugs or alcohol or intoxicants to self-medicate that, which doesn't make the disorder go away, obviously.
Right.
And so sometimes after a lot of drug use, we can fall into depression, or we can fall into some type of personality disorder. So, you know, it's the which came first, the chicken or the egg. It can be both.
Right. And that's the... that's the tricky part. I don't even need to translate that because, you know, and that's the thing, like sometimes, at least from my limited experiences, sometimes people are on a medication to treating depression or how about this? When I went to rehab, the doctor put me on a blood pressure medicine before I went. I was seeing a doctor.
Right.
And he put me on blood pressure. Well, my blood pressure was high. Because I was doing cocaine all the time.
Right.
So once I got off cocaine, then the blood pressure wasn't an issue, right?
Shocking. Right.
Yeah. Right. Your heart's beating awfully fast. Yeah, it might have been the cocaine. And so that's kind of the same thing with mental illness. If somebody, they're going to the doctor, their family says, oh, you got to go to the doctor. You're sleeping all the time. You're this, you're that. And they go to the doctor, and the doctor puts them on something because they don't disclose, oh, I'm using pills.
Yeah.
And so then they get this psychomedication that's changing in addition to the drugs and lifestyle. And so that's always been something that's, you know, I guess a challenge just from my conversations with you is like, how do you differentiate that? Like when somebody's coming to you and they already have that diagnosis and you know they have substance abuse because they've self-identified with that and you've done your assessment and you're like, hey, obviously you have a drug and alcohol problem and you're on these meds, what's that process like for you to be able to go, what's the hottest fire kind of thing?
Yeah, so that's a really, really good question, and a question that I think unfortunately some practitioners really don't ask. You know, my drug of choice was cocaine too, right? And when I was high, I was up. When I ran out of money, I was down, right? And that mimics a condition called bipolar disorder. And so the most commonly misdiagnosed condition when it comes to people struggling with a substance use disorder is bipolar disorder, either one or two. And there are some slight but significant differences between the two of them. The most common practitioners in America today who diagnose mental illness are family doctors.
Right.
Now, family doctors have some training in medical school, have some experience when they're doing their residency in mental illness. But from my experience, not all of them really understand it.
Right.
And so oftentimes, on at least on a weekly basis, I have someone come in to my practice whose family doctor has diagnosed them with some type of mental health disorder, ADHD, bipolar disorder, that they just simply don't have. It's a product of the drug use. And
right.
So what a good practitioner should do, what I do, is especially if they're in a controlled environment, I will see if it's feasible to take them off the medication for a finite period of time just mm-hmm. to monitor them, give it a chance for the medication to get out of their system, monitor their behaviors, and there's a chance they don't need to be on it. It was just a product of the drug use. With
right.
any psychotropic medication, you got to be really, really careful because it's literally changing the way the neurotransmitters in your brain fire.
Right. And you work, and so you're working a lot in conjunction with medical doctors,
yeah.
too, in order to, and we've had these conversations too about holistically treating somebody, right? Like,
right.
so, you know, you're doing these assessments, and then when you're taking them off, that's in, you're working with a medical.
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
We have a medical doctor on staff at my practice, and I've worked for psych hospitals, residential treatment facilities, and I've worked underneath some really great psychiatrists and board-certified addictionologists.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really helped me to delineate those things, to parse out what's real mental illness or what is just a cause of substance use disorder. And I'll give you a prime example. For people who use methamphetamine,
mm-hmm.
cocaine does it too, but mainly methamphetamine, you know, there's a condition called amphetamine-induced psychotic disorder, right? And a psychotic mm-hmm. disorder just means you're paranoid and you're hearing stuff, seeing stuff that's not there.
Okay.
Now, of course, when you're doing methamphetamine,
that's the effect.
That's
right.
the effect.
That's what we're trying to get.
Right, but it can, those same symptoms, those psychotic symptoms can persist for 6 months after your last
wow.
use of methamphetamine.
Wow.
And one thing that I am screaming from the rooftops, I'm trying to get the word out about, is the new high THC oils and cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really growing evidence that that they're causing psychotic disorders, right?
Whoa.
I've seen 5 patients in my office in the last 18 months, all of whom under 20 years old, all the symptoms of a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder,
mm-hmm.
But no preconditions that would tell me they should have it. Usually you can predict with some certainty if someone's going to develop a psychotic disorder because of family history, because of hard drug use in adolescence and teenage years.
Yeah.
And so when I see 5 under 20 patients come in who have none of those things, all they've
right.
done is smoke high THC oil, that's
yeah.
really, really scary.
Oh, I bet, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was my first, you know, I was sharing my story with these guys. Inked Ministries came and shared, they filmed me and talked about my tattoos, and I shared my story, and you know, I started using drugs young, probably 11, 12, drinking, smoking, and then getting into hallucinogens. And for the most part, those first couple years was fun and in consequences.
Right.
But then when I started doing methamphetamines at about 15 years old,
mm-hmm.
I noticed, number one, a deep shift in just my world became much
right.
darker. My thoughts became darker. My criminal activities became darker. Everything was just darker, almost demonic in a
right.
sense, right? And I remember, you know, trying to get off of it, you know. And somebody told me that it was it has a relatively short half-life in your body,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I was experiencing these things where I was trying to go to sleep. I had maybe not used for a day or two, and I would have these dreams when I was falling asleep that I would be falling,
right?
And the only way to pull myself out would be to scream,
right,
and wake myself up out of it. And I called, they had a hotline at the time, and I called that hotline, and they were like, "Oh, you're just going through withdrawals right. from methamphetamines." But I've always kind of wondered, like, I wonder what those years of meth use at that early age, because I have kids that are, you know, right about that age, you know, and I have an 18-year-old, I have a 13-year-old, and 12-year-old, you know, which is great that they're not, pretty confident that they're not.
You would know.
Right. I would know.
Right.
And so, but I think of that and I think, man, like those are years on my brain's developing, my thoughts, my identity. The fact that I can even be here today and do what I'm doing now today, I mean, it's a gift of God, really.
It's a miracle.
It's grace. It's a miracle.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to tell you, like, of my friends that we ran with, there's not very many of us who made it out of there.
Yeah, me too.
Right? So, and I have some friends who recently after rehab, who I worked with in the studio, we were doing music, and he confessed to me that he thought somebody was listening to his, was able to listen to his voices, his thoughts.
That's called thought casting.
Yeah. And, you know, he's in my studio and we're talking about it, and I love the guy, you know, but... So I'm trying to listen to him and not completely dismiss him. Like, dude, you're freaking crazy.
Right.
You know, so I'm trying to like, well, what, tell me, how does this work? You know? Right. I mean, he swore it was true.
Yeah. You know? So that's about 6 months ago, I was asked to do an evaluation to see if a county jail inmate was competent to stand trial. Did he know what he was doing when he committed the crimes?
Oh, wow.
And so the state psychologist had diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, right? And so his parents were skeptical of that. And so they hired me to go in, and I found out he'd been doing methamphetamines daily for 2 years.
Oh.
Right. Now, he'd been in jail for 4 months at the time, but as I mentioned earlier, the psychotic symptoms can persist for up to 6 months. And so the fascinating part is I changed the diagnosis and I did expert witness testimony, and within 6 months, at the six-month mark, right around there, he stopped having the psychotic symptoms, but his memory of the events that caused paranoia when he was having the symptoms was real to him. In other words,
he thought, it was imprinted,
it was imprinted. And so he thought that, you know, the common paranoias involved the FBI being after me or the Freemasons or the Catholic Church, right? And these big grandiose thoughts and grandiose paranoia. And even though, when I talked to him after the 6 months, he wasn't having the symptoms. And he could conceptualize, that's crazy. There's no way that the FBI or the Catholic Church was after me.
Mm-hmm.
But in his mind, it was real. And
when
it comes to that, right, different drugs of abuse affect different parts of our brain, affect different neurochemicals in our brain.
Yeah.
The most common ones are dopamine, endorphin, serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA. And then with marijuana, it's anandamide. And so with methamphetamines and stimulants, they affect your frontal cortex, this front part of your brain, right? That's where God put our morality. That's where God put our decision-making, right?
Mm-hmm.
That part of the brain's not even fully developed in males till they're about 25.
Oh, boy.
Developed in females when they're about 22 or 23.
Wow.
So that's why girls make better decisions than we do sooner, right?
Right.
And so, you know, when it comes to drug use in the teenage years and your prefrontal cortex, you can absolutely do permanent damage. That's why I am I'm very, very hesitant, extremely hesitant to ever recommend a teenager be on a stimulant medication for ADHD.
Right.
In adults, it's proven to be very effective and can even help you stay sober if you are self-medicating your ADHD. But anything that affects that frontal cortex, especially your prefrontal cortex, during your developmental years can cause problems later in life.
Right, and so you're, I mean, it's, you're saying this is not necessarily that it's a street drug, but the fact that no matter how they're obtaining it, right, they're getting it through a prescription, through a licensed medical professional, that, you know, the as that part of the brain is forming, that there could be some harm being caused there.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, in America today, medical doctors are the biggest drug dealers in the country. Now, I think they're doing things with very, very good intentions.
Yeah.
But the reason medical doctors prescribe medicine is that's because that's what they're taught to do.
Right.
And they want to help. You know, they have a kid coming in and he can't concentrate. He's impulsive. The doctor, I believe, got into, you know, most of them got into it for legitimate reasons, for genuine reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what they're taught to do. They're taught to prescribe medication, and we need to start training our doctors differently.
Right. Yeah. Well, so my limited experience in this is a couple years ago. I was sober. Still sober. This word that right? Just get that clear before someone fires me. But I was experiencing depression, anxiety. Yeah. I was suicidal.
Yep.
It was the work, and I was working out. I was eating properly. I was going to meetings. I was a part of a men's group. I was going to church. I was volunteering at church. I was doing all the right things, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, I got to do something. And I don't know who this person was, but God bless them. They recommended me to an addictionologist, Dr. Susan Blank. And I went to her, and she did, and I guess she's a psychiatrist and a medical doctor.
Right.
And I think she had something else that she was trained in or certified in or something. And what she did is she did the psychological profile. She did a brain scan. Mm-hmm. She did a hormone panel. She did a full blood work on my vitamins and my vitamin deficiencies. And then she put me on a regimen. Mm-hmm. And she understood, hey, I'm an addict. So giving me Xanax, probably not going to be the good thing. You know, putting me on some sort of stimulant to help me concentrate, probably not going to be good.
Right.
And she had all these different holistic things that she did to help me. One of the things that she put me on was Gabitrol.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it, Gabapentin, I think is what it was.
Yeah, Neurontin and Gabapentin, same medication.
Gabapentin. And so I took it at night, right? Like I took one or two at night when I went to sleep. Over time, I noticed my anxiety decreased tremendously. There was no, I didn't get any kind of high or any kind of, it didn't help me sleep. It didn't do any of those things for me. And when I went to I saw her, now she's a private pay, right?
Right.
Insurance people don't cover that.
Yeah, cash pay.
Right. So eventually I ran out of money.
Right.
And she said, God bless you, but I can't do it for free.
Right.
Right. And so I went to my family practitioner doctor, and I'm like, hey, can you keep me on this? Because this is helping me with my anxiety. And she says, this is for nerve pain, and I'm not prescribing you this.
Yeah.
You know? And which she says, look, that other doctor did, but that's not what I do, so I'm not going to put it on it. So, I mean, I was okay. I worked it out. I've managed many other different ways spiritually as well, right? But that, to me, is like that's my hard evidence of what we're talking about, the difference.
And absolutely, doing a lot of drugs, especially hard drugs during your adolescent and teenage years, can lead to mental health diagnosis later in life, right? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned addictionologist. So an addictionologist is a medical doctor who also has a board certification in something else. Mm-hmm. Sometimes their board certification is in psychiatry, and then they also do a board in addiction medicine. It's governed by the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And so they are absolutely the best doctors to treat addiction. They're the best doctors to treat co-occurring disorders. Mm-hmm. There's just not a whole lot of them out there, and a lot of them don't take insurance. And you know, when it comes to anxiety, depression, gabapentin works on a neurotransmitter called GABA. That's what's gabapentin.
Right.
GABA is the same neurotransmitter that Xanax and Valium work on, the right. same neurotransmitter that alcohol works on, but not nearly as addictive. And so if someone's experiencing depression, anxiety, and you find a medication that works for you, you're actually pretty blessed because it's easy to take a medication. Psychotherapy is hard. And to be honest, you know, I am anti-medicine unless somebody needs medicine. And if they need medicine, I'm absolutely pro-medicine. And, you know, this brain, our brain is an organ, just like any other organ. And when organs dysfunction, they cause symptoms. If your pancreas dysfunctions, doesn't regulate sugars, you get the symptoms of diabetes. When your brain dysfunctions, the symptoms are behavioral. And that's stigmatized, isn't it? But it's simply an organ with a dysfunction that's producing symptoms. And fortunately, in 21st century, America, we have medications that can treat organs with dysfunctions, but it doesn't always work, right? And I think the mistake a lot of people make, you know, life has ups and downs. You know, I lose a relationship, someone dies. That causes some depression. That does not need medication most times.
That's a natural response to life occurrence.
And so when I recommend medication is if, you know, there's a persistent condition with symptoms that doesn't seem to be caused by any stressful life event. And when you talked about vitamins, and for anybody who's listening who has been diagnosed with depression, anxiety, or even a psychotic disorder like schizoaffective disorder, absolutely minerals in your body, deficiencies of those minerals can absolutely cause those symptoms. The three most important ones are your B vitamins, your D vitamins, and niacin. If you have low vitamin B, that can be the singular cause of a depression or a mood disorder. And also schizoaffective disorder, and there's a lot of research out there about that. It's worth a shot to try a natural route before going to see doctor for a...
She had me, she had me taking, I still take vitamin D. And I take a vitamin 12, a B12 or whatever it is, vitamin. So let's talk a little bit about, before our time's up, if there's a parent who's listening and... or a loved one of anyone who they feel like is are having these issues, whether the, you know, they're worried that their loved one is using drugs, but there's there's also these other things happening. What are some handles or what's some information? How can we help somebody in that position who's listening right now?
And that's a great question, one that I get a lot. And you know, when it comes to, let's say, a teenager who's experiencing depression, right? I think it's a lot harder to be a teenager today than it was when I was a teenager a million years ago, right? And I'm seeing a lot more depression and anxiety in my office from teenagers than I ever have in my career. And, you know, so let's say a kid's getting bullied at school, low self-esteem, doesn't fit in, maybe has a rough home life, which causes depression. That depression is real. And that depression is present. And they drink a beer or smoke cannabis for the first time. For the first time in 3 years, my depression is gone. That is powerful, right? And so the next time they're feeling that way, they're going to go to the one thing they found works. Now, they're not thinking, this is a bad decision. I'm going to develop an addiction. They're just thinking, I want this pain to go away. And so sometimes while using drugs to self-medicate is a bad decision, sometimes we make bad decisions with good intentions. And I think it's imperative for parents to realize that, I think it's imperative to have a relationship with your children that's open. And I also think it's imperative that if you notice certain signs, to ask them about it. To say something about it and get them to a mental health professional, before it gets out of hand. And unfortunately, I'm on a I'm on my local county's youth suicide coalition, mm-hmm. and we're seeing suicides rise and rise and rise.
Yeah.
And it's really, really sad. And so when I'm out speaking, or when you and I are out speaking, Christian, you know, we really encourage parents to you're the one to do something about it.
Yeah.
Right? Don't wait for a teacher to notice it.
Yeah.
Say something about it. You literally could save a life.
And that's been my own practice in my own home. And, you know, I'm pretty straightforward.
Right.
You know, my filter's pretty worn thin.
It is.
And
it
so is. So I have those conversations. I mean, I ask them, I say it by name. Do you smoke weed? Do you know anyone who smokes weed? You know, is anyone taking pills? You know, don't take any pills if you're going. I want it, because what I want to do is I want to call that thing out loud, so that they understand that I understand what's happening. Because, you know, it's a matter of fact. You know, I mean, if you're growing up, you're in middle school, you're in high school, those things are happening around you.
They absolutely are.
Yeah.
No matter where you go.
So having the conversation, and I know that it's really hard for some people. Like for you and I, we have some life experience that makes it very clear. It's very easy for us to have those conversations. But for the parent who hasn't had that, you know, that's a tough thing to do. But I think, like what you're saying, like that's the front line. Have those conversations, you know. And, oh, Mom, what are you talking about? But do it, you know.
You got to do it. And it starts with education, you know. You know, since I work in the treatment world, my kids are around it all the time. I take my 7-year-old and 2-year-old to the sober living I work at, and they love running around there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little easier for us because we're in this industry. But some parents, you know, they don't want to believe that my child has a problem. So we're just going to ignore it, and maybe it'll go away.
Right.
And that's the worst way to handle it. And if mm-hmm. you started having a conversation with your children about addiction, about mental illness at a young age, so that it is not this big stigmatized topic. Well, Mommy and Daddy have talked to me about this before. So when it comes time something happens, they're a little more open about it. And also, I think educating them on what to look for, what to look out for.
Yeah.
It's our responsibility as parents not to be our kids' friends, to be their parents.
Yeah.
And I don't want my boys to sleep in a park like I used to.
Right. Right. Well, man, I think this has been great. You know, we just kind of started riffing on this. We're hoping to, I think we mentioned in the beginning, we're going to be doing something in the Roswell area for parents. And then we'd like to do more of this. You know, I love the way you describe it, the way you break it down. It's so simple. It makes so much sense. And so I'm hoping that we do more of this. We get you down in here and crack that mic open for you.
Man, I would love to come back and do it. This is what we do. This is how we roll. And
So
I'll come back anytime you want.
Yeah. Appreciate you, man. I appreciate your service and you being here today. All right, peoples, love you. This is the Most High Show.
God bless.